What I'm going to talk about today is a little bit of winter preparedness, a very little bit about winter survival, and maybe a little bit about avalanches. I grew up in Florida, so I didn't get into winter stuff until quite late in life. I went to school in Colorado, and when I was in college, that really started getting things going. I also have a bug in my throat today. But there was an outdoor club there, and that's actually where I learned most of what I know is in school, and also going out with people that also were good at it. And that's probably, you can read a lot about it, you can hear about things, and here somebody asked me today if we're going outside, and I said no, and I'm like, you really ought to be outside, because that's what it's all about. But if you can hook up with somebody who knows what's going on, you're a lot better off. Like I say, you can read till your eyes fall out, not really know what you need to know. You have to experience it. The other thing is, if at school there isn't anybody doing that sort of thing, I don't know, does PLU have an outdoor club or recreation club or something? Do they do much?
They offer plenty, but nobody goes on.
Why? You can usually get people to come and speak at club meetings, and a lot of times that's what the school that I went to did, is get Forest Service people or Park Service people, or sometimes people from within the college that have had experience in it. There was a fellow at Rocky Mountain National Park when I was there who I think had spent his whole life in the backcountry in the wintertime, and he just knew everything there was to know, and he was the greatest guy to go out with. It's just innumerable little tiny things that make life so much easier, and he had gotten them all down to a fine art. But he was really good at teaching other people about it too. So that's the best way to do it. Failing that, you can read books, and I've got a stack of books which I can leave if people would like to look at them. Obviously, I need some of them next weekend anyway. This little Sierra Club tote book is probably your best beginning wilderness skiing. It tells you how to dress and what to do and what to take and a little bit about equipment and some really great pictures in the back of all these wonderful places you can go skiing in the world. But it's real basic. I'm not real sure it's still in print, actually. You should check that out. But it's pretty good. Another really good one, which takes like half an hour to read, is this Understanding Avalanches. It's put out by Signpost Magazine over in Linwood, I think. And it's real basic. It doesn't teach you a lot about snow physics, which you don't really need to know. But just things to watch out for, some of the things we may talk about today. This is a real, real helpful little pamphlet. If you're at all interested in the outdoors, you've probably seen Mountaineering Freedom of the Hills. This is probably geared a lot more towards summer and climbing versus sort of general recreation and skiing and that sort of thing. But it also has some good information in it. So you probably want to look at. This is another one which I think your library should have. Avalanche Safety for Skiers and Climbers. It's an excellent, really, I'll say really basic. It's basic, but it's got some really good information in it. A lot of really good pictures. And a lot of the pictures show slopes with slides that have slid, places that you might want to cross or not cross, good routes and bad routes. And somehow it's easier to look at a picture than look at a little diagram or listen to somebody talk about it. You might just at least take a look at the cover. I don't know how many of you can see this nice big slide coming down off the slope here. There's about six people down here at the bottom. I'm glad I'm not them. I wouldn't want to be down there. Has anybody done any winter overnight camping? Okay. How about long day trips where you're gone, say out skiing or snowshoeing like 6 hours or more, other than those same people? Okay. A lot of what I'm going to say is geared towards not particularly overnight things, but longer trips. If you're just going to go from here to the trail junction and back, or a mile down the road and back, some of this may not be appropriate, but it's stuff you should know as background information. When I went down to the junction this morning, I didn't take a pack, and you can decide when we get into packs what of that equipment that you would have wanted to take. But one thing that everybody has to do when you go out at all is get dressed. I know that sounds real basic, but a lot of the problems that people have in the winter is because of how they got dressed in the morning. And if you're going to get dressed to come here and sit all day, you should probably dress differently than if you're going to go out and spend the whole day outside. Some of you look like you're ready to go spend the whole day outside. Some of us are ready to sit inside for the day. I hope this doesn't seem like too basic information. If it is, just keep knitting and don't pay much attention to it. Something to keep in the back of your mind, and I have a little trouble with this, I guess just showing my age, because I've been doing it for so long. It's stuff that I don't think about anymore. And so to sit down and actually talk about it, like I say, it may seem a little basic. Starting on the from the inside going out, long underwear is a matter of personal preference. I wear bottoms all the time. I hardly ever wear tops. Ken, who will be here next weekend with the Avalanche seminar, never wears long underwear when he goes skiing. So it's just a matter of what you want to do, what you a little bit about where you're going to be too. Obviously, if you're just going down to the junction and back, maybe you're going to work up a sweat. You're not really going to want long underwear. The whole point of it is that it takes the sweat that you're creating and wicks it away from your body. We'll get a little bit more into why you want to do that in a little bit, but you want to get the moisture away from your skin. And so any kind of polypropylene, I think, is that topic? They make them in turtlenecks or just plain crewnecks, V-necks, or zippers, anything that actually pulls that moisture away. Wool is another one. A lot of people don't like to wear, itchy long wool underwear. It also does that same thing. Silk is not bad. You can afford it. You can afford it. Come talk to me afterwards and we'll work out a deal. What you're trying to do is get that moisture away, because if you don't get it away, what's going to happen when we get to the outer layers, the moisture from the outside is going to come in. You want the movement to be away from your skin. It's, like I say, it's pretty basic. Long johns, tops and bottoms. Socks are another thing to think about. A lot of people just wear rag wool socks. Wool is not bad for wicking. It also is warm when it's wet, and that's sort of the critical thing. Polypropylene is also, silk is a little less warm anytime, but it does have that wicking property. Get into outer footwear in a minute, but inner footwear is probably, at least for me, it's the most critical thing. I've gone through probably every combination of types of socks and numbers of socks that fit in my boots to find out what's comfortable. And for each person, it's going to be a little bit different. It's better if you can fit two pairs of socks in your boots. If your boots are going to be tight, you're better off with just one. What you're trying to do is keep the circulation going so your feet don't get cold. My feet get cold so easily. You may have noticed me clomping around in these great huge boots. They're actually double boots. The inner is sort of a felt liner, almost like packs have. Most people don't wear these touring because they're just big and heavy. I originally got them when I was doing a lot of overnight backcountry trips. But two loose socks are better than three tight socks. One loose sock is better than two tight socks. And again, just the idea that blood can keep moving. Blood is what keeps you warm. You want to keep that blood moving as much as you can. I should have said, if you have any questions or don't understand something, speak or snore loud. Or
wicking?
Wicking? Wicking. I guess it's sort of a technical closed technology term or something. All it means is that it takes that moisture and moves it away. If you wear a thin nylon layer next to your skin, it's going to hold the moisture in right next to your skin. The fibers in the clothing actually pick up the moisture, and a lot of the materials are like bound fibers, and they run like from inner to outer, even though they don't look like it. You can't tell when you look at it. But wool has so many little fibers, I don't know what else to call them, fuzzy things on them, that all of those pick up the moisture and move them in one direction. And like I say, nylon just simply doesn't do that. Cotton doesn't do it very well. Cotton absorbs it real well. If you're trying to mop up a puddle on the floor, cotton rag's better than a wool rag. But if you're wearing it, it's going to keep that moisture right next to it, and you want to get it away from your skin. Might as well talk about moisture. The whole thing about moisture is that it cools. If you're hot in the summer and you sweat, you're actually cooling up. That's one way of cooling. If you're really hot, you pour a bucket of water over your head. As it evaporates, you feel cooler. I worked for a long time in the desert, and they have those canvas bags. Water tastes terrible. Put the water in the bag, and it actually evaporates through the flax or the linen of the bag and cools the water. What you're trying to do is prevent that. And so the farther away the moisture is from you, the less likely you are to be cooled off. And wind compounds that problem. Because it is evaporating the water, and so it's just cooling your skin all the time. Try it sometime. Take your hand outside when it's wet and just wave it around in the air. Obviously, it gets a lot colder. If you can dry it off or have something that will take that moisture away, that's really all the wicking does. Okay? Your middle layer, outer, over your long underwear, again, is a little bit a matter of preference. I wear turtlenecks all winter long. Kendall hates turtlenecks, so the two of us have really different body metabolisms, and we get cold at different temperatures. Zip neck turtlenecks are really nice. We're going to talk a little more about head and neck too, but you lose a lot of heat, you know, through your head and neck. If you are getting hot, you can't really take the turtleneck off, but if you can unzip it and kind of let some of that heat escape, you can cool off a lot faster if that's the problem. Wool shirts are okay. Most turtlenecks are nylon and cotton, and that's not great. But if you've got that inner layer that's at least getting the moisture away from your skin, that helps. Wool is real nice if you can afford those. Again, if you want to buy a wool turtleneck, come talk to me afterwards. Nylon's not bad. A lot of stretchy type winter clothes are nylon. And again, it doesn't have any insulating value, but it's not bad just for a little bit of wind protection. Sun protection's another thing. If you're here next weekend, we'll probably have some pictures of what sun can do in the winter. Pretty amazing. And again, flannel is actually cotton, but it does have a little more insulating value, so it's probably better than nylon, but not by much. Probably my strongest feeling about winter clothing is wool pants. I just almost shudder every time I see somebody skiing in blue jeans. And I think that's because I've been with people that have skied in blue jeans and been really, really miserable. It doesn't take long. Now, again, if you're just, you know, going out for a mile here, maybe it's not that big a deal. Cotton simply has no value when it's wet. You might as well take it off. You'd be warmer. I know that sounds pretty crazy, but cotton when it's wet just isn't worth anything. Wool when it's wet, it sounds crazy too, but wool does provide some insulation when it's wet. Take a cotton glove and a wool glove and dip them in a bucket of water and go outside and see which hand stays warmer. Polypropylene also does sort of the same thing. I haven't had quite as much luck with that as, you know, pants. Most of the like pile pants, the really heavy things, are just too hot. And these are wool. You know, they're really lightweight. You don't have to get great big huge heavy duty, you know, mountaineering type pants. And somebody that sews, you know, elastic waist and a few pockets are nice. Corduroy pants are probably a little better than plain blue jeans, but again, not by much because they're mostly cotton. They do have a little more insulating value because they've got the airspace between the actual rows of cords. Knickers are, again, a matter of personal preference. I used to wear a lot of knickers. It seems easier to take off your socks and, you know, change your socks and put dry socks on than have to worry about pant legs that are wet. But if you're wearing gaiters, which is sort of the next step, you shouldn't have that problem with longer pants. One problem with knickers is how they fasten around below your knee. Some of them are elastic. Sometimes that tends to cut off circulation a little too much, although it does accommodate different thicknesses of socks and legs and things. Some of them actually have a buckle. Some of them have a snap. Velcro is probably the worst idea, although it's the easiest. Once you fall down and your muscle kind of tenses up and the Velcro pops open and gets all full of snow, it really doesn't work very well. So knickers are okay. You know, a lot of people ski in them, a lot of people swear by them. And again, they do make those with some of the polypropylenes that are really good for like track skiing. Racers wear them a lot. I've sort of somehow gotten away from knickers, but they're really okay. Your first outer layer is probably one of the more critical ones as far as insulation value. And insulation isn't necessarily thickness or weight as much as dead air space. That's the whole principle behind down. You know, there's a lot of empty space in there, which when you compress it, put it in a stuff sack or something, goes away. When you pull it out, it's all fluffy. When you see birds sitting in the snow in the winter, they've got the feathers all fluffed out, they look real fat. All they're doing is creating a lot of dead air space. And it actually, the body heat that they're radiating is held within that sort of outer covering. And that's all down, and a lot of the new qualifil, holofil, fiberfil type things do also. The one thing about it is that if it doesn't work when it's wet, it's not worth anything when it's wet. Now down is great. Down is probably one of the warmest insulating kinds of things you can find. But if it's wet, you've got two layers of nylon with a little bit of bumps in between it. So if you're going to use down, you've got to be sure to keep it dry, which in the Northwest is a little harder. In the Rockies, lots of people use down vests, down pants, and everything because it's simply not as wet. again, wool is not bad. There's a lot of dead air space, even just the way that wool is woven or knitted. Some of the fiber fill or pile things, feel it. It feels pretty thick, and yet if you squish it, you know, it doesn't squish as much as down does. But there is some dead air space that's held in there. And again, whatever you want to wear on the outside, most of the stuff you may not wear if you're actively skiing someplace, especially if you're going uphill. You have a down vest or a wool vest, of course, like a down sweater. Probably not going to be wearing a full-fledged down jacket if you're just, you know, doing average skiing. Probably one of the worst things for the outer layer is cotton. Again, this is the same thing as blue jeans.
Does the house still work when it's wet?
It's
It's not as bad as down.
No, it's definitely not as bad as down. It probably doesn't feel as warm as wool, just because it's a man-made fiber. But it does have a lot of dead air space in it. A lot of those fibers are, like they say, hollow. It's actually a long, hollow nylon tube that's woven into a thread.
I was just a hollow film and hollow film about 70 or 80% of the heat value.
When they're wet?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to take my Holofil sleeping bag and dunk it, and then try to sleep in it. I've never had the nerve.
I've slept in Holofil bags when they're drenched in Sabah.
And you're here to tell us about it.
In Alaska. Okay.
And your very last layer is going to be pretty extreme. It might be sort of your survival suit, if you want to call it that. Something that you would not normally wear. Something that even when you stop for lunch, you probably aren't going to put on, but you might want to have in the bottom of your pack for a long, long day trip. And again, that's sort of large down coats. I have some fiberfill pants I'll bring next week that are about this thick, and I've probably only worn them half a dozen times in 12 years, but the times that I had them, I was really glad that I had them. Super sort of blizzard-type conditions. Another sort of outer layer, which you may wear more often, would be simply wind protection. A nylon wind shirt, a lot of the new Gore-Tex, there's all kinds of new, crazy breathable but waterproof type fabrics. I don't believe a word of it, but people swear by them. Biotex, and I don't even know what all the new ones are.
Leak-Tex,
yes, there's lots of Leak-Texes. And another thing to remember is your legs. A lot of people think about the last outer layer as only being jackets. Simple pair of wind pants, which are very small, you know, roll up real small in your pack, could be a real lifesaver. If you've got the wicking action, your long underwear, the insulating value of wool pants, wind pants may be all you need for a lot of extreme conditions. I mentioned lunch stops. That's probably the easiest thing to not do. You've been skiing uphill all morning, you've worked up a good sweat, and you peeled off all your excess layers. You're just feeling really, you know, maybe you're not sweating real hard, but you're feeling real warm. And you stop for a break or you stop for a lunch stop. First thing. You're going to want to put on more clothes. Immediately your body starts losing a lot of that excess heat. And if you can trap it, you put your dead air space on, you're going to keep all that heat in and stay warmer through lunch. Now, eventually, you know, there's not going to be that much heat being created. You're going to start getting cold again. But a lot of people wait till they start getting cold and then put the clothes on. You put them on while you're still pretty warm and stay warmer longer. And even if you're only stopped for, you know, 20 minutes or something, it can make a pretty big difference. What else would you want to wear or take to wear? Something for your head. If you don't wear wool pants, if you don't have wool socks, if you don't have polypropylene underwear or fiber jackets, whatever you do, take a hat. You lose something like 70 to 80% of your body heat simply through your head. If we all sat in here with hats on and t-shirts, we'd probably be about as warm as we are right now. The head and neck area is just sort of incredible in the fact that there's a lot of blood vessels real close to the surface, and you can just lose an incredible amount of heat. Again, if you're skiing real hard, you don't want to wear a hat. Anne's been out skiing a couple of days and wearing her hat. I'm always wearing
my
hat. Had it in your pocket, though. If you don't want to wear a hat, you may want to just have a headband that covers your ears. Some people just wear bandanas, which, you know, keep in a little bit of heat, but not much. And again, wool is incredibly much better than acrylic. A lot of the wool hat or the quote winter hats, ski hats that you buy are acrylic, obviously. It doesn't take long to knit them, so it's going on real fast. Scarves are, again, sort of a matter of personal like or dislike. I hate scarves. I just can't stand to have a thing floating around. I always sort of have this vision of going down a trail and the tail flying out behind me, catching on a branch, you know. And I doubt that would happen. You're going to have it tucked in or whatever. Balaclavas are best. I'll dig mine out in a minute. You can actually pull them down over, covers your head and neck at the same time, or you can flip it up and just wear the head part of it. Great little notes. If you were baking bread at 350 degrees normally, and you just put your hat on your head, you'd be baking bread at 100 degrees. And how long would it take to bake your bread? It was late at night when I was making these notes. That's the idea. Think about baking bread at 100 degrees. Okay, and somebody mentioned something for your hands. You can wear gloves. You can wear almost any kind of gloves to get away with. A lot of people just wear leather work gloves. They wear real well. And if you're skiing a lot, you're going to wear out the place between your thumb and your finger real fast. There's not much insulating value in them if they get soaked. You know, they're soaked in, and the leather's probably better than cotton, but not by much. You can even go to fingerless gloves, which if you're knitting is real handy because you don't have to worry about all those long fingertips and fixing the tips of them. Lightweight gloves are generally adequate. Again, polypropylene gloves are not bad. Supposedly you can wring them out and put them back on. They're nice and toasty. And they make some just incredibly heavy wool gloves. You can't hardly move the fingers in them because they're so thick. Better than any kind of glove is a mitten. Your fingers are together, your hands are creating their own warmth and keeping them. When you've got each finger insulated individually, it's going to take a lot longer to warm it up if you can put them all together. The other thing about gloves is you can always kind of slip your hand out and make a ball of it, and your thumb gets a lot warmer that way. And then over a mitten, again, sort of getting to your extreme outer layer, you might want some kind of a mitten shell, nylon or maybe leather, which goes over the whole thing. Most of them have a elastic cuff, so it's sort of like a gaiter between your mitten and your shirt. And I always wore those when I was learning to ski going downhill, because I was always falling and all the snow would go off my sleeve. So even if I was only wearing gloves, lightweight gloves, a lot of times I'd put the shells on just to keep the snow from, you know, it's not going to kill you, but I snow off my sleeve. And they also make a lot of Gore-Tex shells now, which are expensive, but serve the same purpose. And again, if you have somebody that can sew, you know, simple coated nylon makes really handy, easy to make shells. What else I'm going to put on? I'm going to go out on this monster. Let's keep to work. Boots? Okay, you got to have something on your feet besides your socks. Waterproof boots are helpful. You're never going to totally waterproof them. Some people don't believe that your sweat can't evaporate if your boots are waterproof. I prefer to keep my sweat inside, keep it warm. They're the first things to get cold and the last things to get warm for most people. My hands stay warm when it's incredibly cold, and my feet are always cold. So it somewhat is a matter of personal opinion, but it's the item that's farthest from your heart. By the time the blood gets down there, it's already cooled off a little bit. And once they start getting cold, they're a lot harder to warm up than, say, hands. Even if you're skiing, you're going to be circulating the blood. It gets to your arms and your hands before it gets to your feet. So boots that fit well are important. I mentioned tight socks versus loose socks. How you lace them up can also be important. When I first got these boots, I had a real tendency to lace them real tight over the instep because they seemed like they kind of slipped a lot. What that did was cut off that little tiny blood vessel right on the top of the foot. My toes would get cold. And so think about that when you're getting dressed in the morning.
Can you point where that is?
It's just right on the top.
Okay.
Yeah, it's certainly not the only thing. You can lace them too tight way down by the toes and just, you know, cut off circulation there. But if you can't move your toes, completely curl them up inside your boots, they're probably a little bit too tight. That just means there's that much dead airspace. Now, if you're going to get blisters because of that, you know, there's a sort of a fine line that, again, is a personal thing with each person in each boot. Two pairs of socks also help prevent blisters. I have two spots on both feet that always get blisters. If I'm going on a long trip, I put moleskin on before I go because I know I'm going to get blisters there. It's just the boots, the way the boots fit. So preventative measures are a lot easier to deal with than once you've got the blisters.
put what on?
Moleskin. I'll show you some. It's a...
Dr. Scholl thing.
Yeah, Dr. Scholl. It's sort of a fiber. It's like a real thin layer of felt. And it's got sticky back. You just put it on and it actually provides that surface for something to rub on. A lot of people wait till they get blisters and then put moleskin on. Well, one thing there is that, you know, eventually you're going to have to get that moleskin off when you're just putting blister off you. Hopefully it popped it before that. Some people, what you can do is once you've got the blister, if you've got a little round blister, is to cut a piece of moleskin with a hole in the center for the blister to sort of stick up through. And what that does is the blister's here, and rather than rubbing on the blister itself, it's rubbing on that layer of moleskin. Some people put another whole piece over the top of that. At that point, it's too late, but you've got to deal with it. It's good stuff to carry.
The bookstore sells it.
One there for local business. One other thing that we probably ought to be wearing.
Gaiters.
Long gaiters are infinitely better than short gaiters. They make a lot of gaiters that are only about this long. And it will keep the snow out of your pants, but it's not going to keep your pants dry or your socks dry if you're wearing knickers. So long gaiters are by far preferable. Something to keep it down if you're actually pushing down through a lot of deep, particularly hard packed snow. A strap that goes under your instep is going to make a lot of difference. Most of them have a hook to hook on the lace on the front. And if you want to look at these later, you're welcome to. These are okay. I rebelled against zippers for a long time on gaiters because I thought, you know, that seems like too much mechanical stuff. And I do have another pair. If anybody's interested in looking at them, I'll bring them next week. That are just essentially a hollow tube that are a little bigger than you want them. I can actually put them on over these boots. And then they have grommets and they just lace up the front. Now the problem with that is they lace up the front, gathers a lot of snow, and it's just heavy nylon. So it's not totally waterproof, but they'd be really easy to make. Keeps the snow out of your feet also, keeps your feet warmer. So you got all dressed, you had a good night's rest, you had a good breakfast, and you've done some other things we'll talk about later. But you gotta pack the pack, you gotta figure out what you're gonna take with you. So I think we'll take a tally and see what you can come up with for things that you want to take.
For how long a trip?
Oh, let's say you expect to be gone between 6 and 8 hours. You're going to go early morning, stay out all day. A lot of new snow on the ground, and you've never been there before, but you have a pretty good idea where you're going. UX. Okay. Presumably, you will have waxable skis in this case.
Hammer.
My list, that's up here.
Water.
Okay. I'm going to make a couple different lists here. What else? Food?
First aid kit.
Very good. What else? I've got a long list by the time I'm done.
Somebody else. No.
Okay, help. Take your own help along. Oh, my.
Extra layers of clothes.
Okay, extra clothes. We talked about all those things we're going to have or think about wearing. We're certainly not going to wear them all.
Headlamp,
okay. Flashlight. Headlamps are, again, a lot easier to deal with than flashlights.
Skis and poles.
We'll assume you're wearing them. Carry.
Skis and skin.
Actually, that's not so crazy. If you're going, we'll call it fire starter. They make a lot of different things. A simple little... like an emergency candle, big fat one, is probably the easiest thing to come by. They make little fuel tabs and little funny little metal containers. Saw some down at Golden Florins the other day that are actually in paper cups. You know, little waxy things.
And
sunglasses. Haven't needed those around here for a while, none. Okay, sunscreen. Maybe we'll have that in our first aid kit too, but that's...
Music card.
Mine comes down at a dime. Most payphones need a quarter nowadays.
Maybe something with a waterproof part.
Okay. What are you using for?
It's not the
Emergency shelter.
Okay, emergency shelter. And that can also obviously be used for simply sitting on at lunch, that sort of thing.
Emergency telephone numbers?
Not up here.
Well, let's pretend we're at Holton now.
I'm bringing telephone.
Yeah. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. How about that? We have 10 essentials. Very good. These are theoretically things that you would go nowhere without. Now, I went out this morning with my little belt pack, and I had a number of those things in there, but I didn't have all of them. I didn't take a map, because I knew I wasn't going very far, and I didn't have my compass. Last night, I went out about 4:30, and I stuck my flashlight in. So, essential is, again, sort of a relative term. Extra clothes, it's real helpful if you put those in a waterproof stuff sack. If you're out skiing during a lot of snow and you have all these neat dry clothes in your packs right on the top of the pack and they get all wet, they're obviously not going to do much good. A map is extremely helpful. It will also help if you look at it before you go out. Study the things. If you lose the map or you get separated from whoever has the map, you've at least got some idea of what the terrain is like. Maybe talk to somebody who's been there before, which will help too.
Wouldn't the water be under the tension?
Water really isn't. Some reason. Maybe you sort of include that with food.
Food is under
water. Water, food, water.
I think they include matches and fire starter together. Mm-hmm. Every comfort map that comes. Really ought to have some food. Let's say extra food. Might take lunch. You sit down at lunch and eat your sandwich and your orange and your potato chips. If you're not back by 10 o'clock that night, you're probably going to be getting hungry again. So sort of emergency food or extra food. Knife, matches in either waterproof matches or in some sort of waterproof container. If you look in my pack, you'll see matches. Sunglasses you may not think you need. Go out in the morning and it's cloudy and why bother with sunglasses? You can still get snow blindness on a cloudy day. Snow blindness is simply burning your eyeballs. It happens a lot more frequently on sunny days, especially when the sun's reflecting off snow. But it can, you can get sunburn on a cloudy day. You can get your eyes sunburned on a cloudy day, too. What else might you want to take? It's a 30-pound pack here. It's got a lot more of this stuff in it.
Signaling device.
Okay, signal mirror or some sort of signaling device. Maybe flares if you're in the 50-pound packs.
Oh, paper.
I'm going to put that over. Snow really isn't bad.
Yeah.
What else?
One other thing that if you were going on a long ski trip from here, particularly, that you wouldn't want to go without. Okay, avalanche cord, we'll talk a little bit more about later. Avalanche cord is simply a long piece of cord that you tie around yourself. It trails along behind you, and most of them are about 50 meters long, I think. A lot of them have little metal tabs on them every meter with an arrow, and you're supposed to put the arrow at you, and when somebody finds it, they pick it up and they say, he's this way. Both ends are buried. The idea is that if you're caught in an avalanche, the cord will float. It's real, real light. It will float on top of the surface, and somebody would be able to find you sooner that way. There's some controversy about it. It's better than nothing. At least if you're wearing it, you're thinking about avalanches, if nothing else. There's your friend. He's caught in the avalanche.
Shovel.
That sounds kind of crazy, but you make a lot of really neat little shovels that someone I really ought to have. Nothing else? What about your friend who says, I'm going to go over here and take a picture and finish eating your lunch and pack up all your stuff? Kind of get ready to go and take off. You're sort of going slow and go down the trail a while. You see them and you call them. So you go back and talk some more and they'll hear you. Is there something back here?
Whistle.
A whistle. Whistle is a really simple thing. And actually, I don't think about whistles much. I was thinking this morning, if I were in the village, and I'm not going to carry this 30-pound pack to go up to the bulletin board up the trail, and I'm probably not even going to carry it if I go all the way to the beaver ponds, if I was only going to take either what I can carry in pockets or what I can carry in my little pack, what I take. Of course, I take all my home essentials. And a whistle. I mean, sound carries in the winter, not as well as in the summer, because the snow absorbs a lot of that noise. If you fell 200 yards down the road and had a whistle, you could sit there and blow it like crazy. Somebody's going to hear it. And so I think that's just a real handy little thing that you can always have. Always put a whistle in the car. Something to think about.
I have a stupid question.
Sir.
I don't really know a lot about this stuff, but
ask.
Use a whistle, you don't cause an avalanche. I mean, is it possible?
It's unlikely. Big loud noises like helicopters cause avalanches a lot. Snow plows cause avalanches a lot. Again, depending on where you are. If you're in that bad of a place, you're probably going to be under the snow, having been carried by the avalanche, in which case a whistle won't do you much good at all. But probably just, you know, tooting it wouldn't do that. Something to think about. Anything else? Oh, I have a real heavy pack. And you're welcome to decide what you think I carry in it all the time. Okay, we got a lot of good stuff. I'll tell you what I'll do. We'll see what I've got. I don't know if I've got all this stuff. And I'm going to leave all the stuff laying around, so if you want to come look at it later, you're welcome to. Actually, I sort of planned this, but I didn't really plan it, so who knows what we're going to find it. Okay, I got my gaiters on. I got one hat and my lightweight gloves on, so I'm ready to go. I got my pack. Now, when I go out for a short trip, I'm going to take my little belt pack, so maybe you can decide how much will fit in that size versus how much fits in this size. I have used this pack for overnight trips, by the way, so it's not just my day trips. Water bottle. Wide mouth water bottles are infinitely better in the winter than skinny little narrow neck water bottles. First of all, they freeze less fast. The little ones freeze really fast. Even if they're frozen, it's a lot easier to grip something this big than to grip something this big, especially if your hands are cold. You can hit it on a rock or whatever. It's also easier to fill. If the water gets about half empty and you think it's going to run out before I get home, you might just take some snow and stuff it in there with some water, kind of shake it up a little bit. If it's real cold, it's going to freeze, but it might give you just a little bit more water by the end of the day. It's a lot easier to do with a wide mouth bottle. Dried cherries, a little extra food. One thing that we kind of didn't get to, this is my emergency and repair pot. It's hefty. Got wax, lots of wax, because I don't know what the temperature is going to be. Wax, scraper, and wax, a little bit of cord. You never know when a little bit of cord might come in handy. You can tie your boot to your ski if your binding breaks. You can splint your pole if your pole breaks. Splint your leg if your leg breaks. I mean, that's getting pretty drastic, but it's possible. The strap on your pack breaks. You can tie it up with this. If you have to rig your emergency shelter, you can hold up a little piece of tarp. You can do all kinds of stuff with cord. We'll see some more cord, I'm sure. Spare baskets. Ski poles without baskets aren't worth much. You don't lose them very often, but when you do, it's when you need them the most. It's inevitable. So a couple of spare baskets or a spare basket is handy. And that's, again, if you're going out with, say, 5 or 6 people, that's probably not something that every single person needs to carry. But somebody ought to have a little bit. A little film can, which has a lot of screws and nails and little pieces of hardware and some wire. The screws, were, I was thinking also, it was probably more useful when we all skied on wood skis. If a screw pulls out in some of these modern fangled skis, I have no idea how you'd get a screw into them, unless it was in the same hole. A little bit more wire. I also have a thing about stuff sacks. Everything's in its own little stuff sack. Spare ski tip. Again, when you skied on wooden skis, broke a tip off, it was a real pain to go along and shuffle it up every time you wanted. So you just slip this on the end of the ski and it's an emergency. I guess it's possible to break some of the new ones, but not nearly as likely. I have cable bindings, and it's not very likely that you're going to break a cable either. This goes around the boot on the ski and then there's a latch that tightens it down. A spare cable is real handy when it breaks. Ski wax remover. I'm going to take that with me. Okay, you want to look in our little pocket? We got maps, a notebook. What do you want a notebook for?
Read your last will.
Last will. I enjoyed this trip immensely, however. Okay, there's a lot of garbage. This is my garbage pocket. Sunscreen. Somebody mentioned sunscreen. It's a good thing to have. A lot of the stuff that I have, I've repackaged because I don't want to carry a 6-ounce bottle of sunscreen. I know I'm not going to use that much on a ski trip for a day, so I put it in little things. Lip balm, zinc oxide, anything to keep you from getting sunburn or to help once you've gotten sunburn or windburn particularly. Lips get real chapped in the winter because they're dry, different kind of skin protector, smaller containers. This is magic. This is the most wonderful stuff. Kendall introduced me to this. It comes in a much larger package, but again, once it's Kendall mint cake. It's pure unadulterated mint-flavored sugar. It's emergency food, emergency energy. I'm not going to talk a lot about food. You obviously need balanced, you know, carbohydrates and proteins and fats and all that. Pen, chewing gum, a little bit of wrinkled old matches, chapstick, a lot of junk. Okay, we have waterproof stuff sack full of what?
Clothes.
I always have clothes. Now, I don't carry all the stuff on any one trip. Wool sweater is handy. Just a couple things in here. This is a nylon rain jacket. This is a nylon wind jacket. Now, a lot of people say you're crazy to carry two jackets. One, if somebody else needs a wind jacket, they can wear one of them. You're not very often going to want waterproof stuff because it doesn't breathe. All the sweat's going to just hang inside your clothes. As you know, recently it would have been handy to have some rain gear, essentially waterproof stuff on the outside. I still don't believe in Gore-Tex, and so I tend to carry two things instead of one thing. Extra mittens. Bandanas. Bandanas are great, almost as good as cord for repairing things and fixing things and splinting things and doing things. Balaclava that I mentioned earlier, also made of wool. Can be worn simply as a little hat, or if you get desperate, you can pull it down. A little bit of face neck protection. Great things to have. More mittens. I always have at least one extra pair of hand coverings. If you're going out with people that haven't skied much, they fall down a lot, well, it's going to get wet first. Their gloves or their mittens or whatever. My hands may get cold, and I don't get my last pair of dry mittens, so I often have extras, funky as they may be. Mentioned headbands. If anyone wants a pattern for a nice little wool headband, it's kind of funny. It has a seam right down the middle in the front, but it's sometimes nicer than wearing a full hat. My mitten shells. Again, they go over your whole mittens. These have an elastic cuff, coated nylon on the palm, and a nice little buckle you can cinch down around the end, and that way you're just real hard put to get snow inside. This is extreme. Another bandana. Flashlight. Got my flashlight. Someplace I got the headlamp connection to that. Don't usually use the headlamp, so I keep it sort of separated. They connect together and make one light. Climbing skins. Probably most of you, if you're beginning skiing, aren't going to be using climbing skins for a while. This is the first pair I've owned in 12 years of skiing. I wish I had them long before. They're a fiber thing. Actually, they're all man-made now. They were originally made of seal skin or mohair. And you just hook, they all unfold. They're all stuck together. Hook it over the end of the ski, and it's got a one-way slide to it. So you can slide downhill, but you can go uphill, but you won't slide back down. And it does make going up particularly icy things so much easier. They come with a glue on the bottom, and what you have to do is unglue them, stick this on, and then it sticks to the bottom of the skin, and you pull the tail down. So it runs the whole length of the ski and just enables you to slide up without sliding back again. Sort of have to be careful not to get them too dirty. I keep this plastic in here just so I can get the beginning of the tail unstuck. After a while, you have to re-glue them, but the glue does last for a pretty long while. Went up to Coon Lake. I don't know if any of you have been up to Stehekin, but it's about a mile off the main trail. Probably about 500 feet elevation difference. over Christmas week with some friends. Two of us had climbing skins and two people didn't. And it was just, it was glaze ice the whole way up. It was just miserable skiing. And we were wearing, you know, normal clothes, plodding along uphill with our little climbing skins on. The other two people were down to t-shirts, faces were red, sweat was dripping off of them because they were having to work so much harder because they just simply didn't have, you know, wax wouldn't hold on that stuff. And so it's sort of extreme conditions, but they can save a lot of energy. It's not just a matter of, you know, of it really being easy, but you can save yourself a lot of energy. I'll leave these out. Here's the avalanche cord we mentioned. I've only used it, I think, twice. There's sort of a lot of controversy about whether it really works or not. And like I say, if nothing else, it's cheap, and it makes you think about the fact that maybe there might be some avalanches. Extra foods or my munchies. More munchies. Sunglasses. Another thing that's real handy with sunglasses, which these don't have on them, is some sort of neck cord. If you fall down or simply want to take them off, you don't have to worry about losing them. A lot of the glacier goggles come with them. Real extremes, you'd probably want some sort of side flaps. They make the glacier goggles little leather flaps on the side. Some of them even have a nose cover. Particularly if you're going to be on glaciers, obviously there's going to be a lot of reflection in the sun. I have some pictures next week I'll try to bring on a Grand Canyon ski trip. Most people don't ski at the Grand Canyon, but skiing on the plateau up above, it was hot. I mean, it was like 50 degrees every day, and the sun was reflecting off the snow. And we had brought in sun protection, and so we got real sunburn. But the things that got the most sunburn was the bottom of our chin, the bottom right under our side of our noses. And the guy I was with had a shirt like this with a little flap by the cuff, and he had this little pink streak on the bottom of his arm from skiing along, the sun reflecting there. So sun can really be deadly. Ken's been snowblind. He can tell his snowblind story. I suppose this is my emergency shelter. It's actually a space blanket suit. I've never unfolded it because I'm afraid I'll never get it back in a small enough package again. But it's basically aluminum foil, and that's what most space blankets are.
I wore one on Halloween.
You wore one on Halloween. What were you?
Hello,
that's impressive. Very good. You're looking a man, right? First aid kit, I mentioned moleskin. Just a couple other things that might come in handy. And I was going to ask the nurse if you have in Poland a hypothermia thermometer.
One.
Okay. Most thermometers only go down to, what,
92
or 94? And if you're in severe stage of hypothermia, you're going to be far beyond that. So, again, this is extreme conditions, but you need a thermometer. This one goes down, I think, 75. Measure body temperature, which is cold. There's
one other thing. Don't you need to go down? I mean, does it matter if your body temperature is 80 or 75? Mm-hmm. Does it really matter?
It does.
It doesn't in the field.
No, but
at that point. Well, yeah. The other nifty little thing that I have, I wear contacts, so I always have a little mirror, so this is my signaling device, even though it's in my first aid kit. It's kind of handy. I also have another whistle in here, so two of us are going to get lost. We can whistle back and forth to each other. The other thing that I don't have in my repair kit, but I always used to have, is adhesive tape. It sticks better than any other tape, and again, you can repair almost anything with it. I patched broken skis with adhesive tape. It doesn't work very well, but it's possible. And again, once you put in a first aid kit, you can carry a Band-Aid box if you want to. This is my long day trip first aid kit, and then I have a backpacking first aid kit, so it increases with the length of time you're going to be out. I knew you wondered what was in here. My hole scoop. This is a fairly large shovel to carry in the backcountry. Ken will probably bring his next weekend, which is about a quarter of this size, and certainly a lot lighter. We'll get into talking about avalanches, but when you want to move snow, if somebody's buried an avalanche, you want to move a lot of snow and you want to move it fast. And so I tend to think big and carry a big shovel. Lots of different models on the market. One with a handle like this is a lot easier than one with just a straight handle, particularly if you're cold and you're working with mittens on, and it's hard to hold on to a straight handle, so that sort of handle is nice. not useful for much else. Rain pants? It doesn't rain very often. These are actually my wind pants. They're one and the same, because if it's blowing that hard, I'm cold, I'm not going to be sweating so much, so I don't worry about wearing waterproof pants. If you should happen to have to spend the night out overnight, they also might come in real handy. More cord. Lots of cord in here, I know that. So my candles, some matches, they're probably not very waterproof, although they're in a plastic bag. It's also a little lighter. I wouldn't rely on them, but...
Keep them warm. Butane won't work if it's too cold.
Guess what? Turn up the heat. Fire starter is handy. More cord. I saw these nifty little gadgets over in the store the other night, the all-purpose storm kit. It has matches, candles, sugar, salt, tea, bullion, wire, whistle, signal mirror, and plastic tube tarp. Information to support human life from the Arctic to the desert, all you need, simply. Whatever it comes.
Order now.
This is the other space blanket. This is just a straight space blanket. It's been unfolded. It's got holes in it, but it's the one that I usually carry. And this is sort of my own version of survival kit. Pots and pans are sort of marginal. I'm going to talk about fire building a little bit. What's in here is mostly not stuff that needs to be cooked. Now, you may want to heat water. Candy bars, matches. And those matches aren't going to get wet. In the case, in the pan, in the plastic bag, in the bottom of the pack. Solid fuel tabs. I mentioned some of the candle things they make. A little bit of beef jerky. Put some salt in you. I'm not going to unpack all the rest of this. High-energy cookies. These are special mountaineering shop made. More beef jerky, candy, bullion, tea bags, a bit of a spoon. When you're looking at emergency food or maybe having to spend the night out, again, we'll talk a little bit more about shelters and stuff, but you don't want to stop and make tea. You don't want to stop and make soup. I mean, you may do that eventually. But when you stop, you've decided you're going to spend the night and you're going to do something about surviving and making a shelter. The first thing you want to do is get some energy. So you want stuff that you don't have to cook. So most of my emergency food is not, the cooked stuff is for heating interiors of bodies. Tea and bouillon, you know, will help raise body temperatures, but they're not going to give you much energy very fast. So I tend to like the no cooked stuff. Okay. Should we weave something with all of this? More matches. Just for a little demonstration purpose here. They sell these as variously as survival matches, lifeboat matches, all kinds of things. They have about half the length of them is sulfur. And if you're thinking about, you know, you're sitting in the woods with this little pile of tinder that's a little bit wet, and your match gets going, maybe. It usually goes out. You're doing this with mittens on, don't mind you. It's going to burn. It's going to burn. It's going to burn. It's a lot easier than something that does that for 2 seconds. There goes the smoke alarm, right? Anyway, those are real handy things to have stashed away someplace. I think... Oh. Two other things. One is my nifty little... all-purpose tool, and again, when people wore wood skis and had a lot more problems with binding the things, little tools were handier. Screwdriver, pliers, and wrench all in one. And a thermometer. Now, a thermometer, this is an air temperature thermometer, not a body thermometer. When we talk about avalanches, especially next weekend, it's important to know about the temperatures. Now, when you walk out the door and you see the thermometer here and you go skiing, now, are you going to be able to tell if it's 6 or 8 degrees different an hour later? If you're really good, maybe you will. I probably couldn't. And that may make some difference depending on what the temperature is. If it's changing from 10 to 16, it's probably not as big a deal. Changing from 31 to 37, it's a lot bigger deal. So, you know, sit down at lunch, take a rest break or something, hang a thermometer on a tree and see what it does. So what don't I have? A first aid kit, my clothes, my flashlight, compass and a map. Oh, knife's in my pocket. Don't lose your knife in your pocket. Matches, candle, sunglasses, shelter. Whistle, shovel, avalanche cord, signal, watch, Don't lose a watch if you fall down either. That's another.
He's no toilet to wear. Paper.
No toilet paper. You're right. Food, water. I didn't bring the camera. That's the one thing I didn't bring. But you might think about what of all that stuff you'd stuff in a little belt pack for your hour or 2 hour trip. Obviously, it's not all going to fit.
The shovel.
The shovel you probably are going to want to take. And the one nice thing about most of those packs, this one actually can go on the outside. There's loops. Snowshoe bindings probably cause more trouble than anything else. I mean, if the snowshoe itself breaks or the webbing comes apart somehow, it's probably not much you're going to be able to do in the field anyway. And that also goes for spring and fall as much as midwinter. Wet cotton, there was a couple in a canoe up in Stehek in the summer that had rented the canoe, gone across the lake. For some reason, they dumped the canoe. We never quite figured out why. But, you know, the water is pretty cold in the lake, even in the middle of summer. They had hung around for a while, and he had it in his head that he should stay with the boat. She said, "We're not going to get rescued soon. Let's go to shore." So they swam to shore, and he was a poor little skinny guy. His ankles were about that big around. They got to shore, and somebody had seen him, and we got over there. But he had taken his shirt off, I guess, or she had taken his shirt off for him. And he had a quarter of pants and cotton socks, and he was just, he was literally standing there just shivering like this, and he couldn't do anything. We'll get hypothermic shortly, but the first thing he did was just peel his pants off, peel his socks off, and you could just almost see him relapse, because that cotton clothing just kept in that moisture so bad, so good,
so
whatever.
So bad.
Okay, so you got up and you had your good night's sleep and you ate a good breakfast and you got dressed and packed your pack. When we get ready to go out, there's a lot of things you have to think about before you go. Now, again, if you're going 3/4 mile down the road, you're probably not going to do most of these things. But if you're going on a longer trip, there probably are some considerations, things that you're going to do before you go and while you're out. What's the first thing you're going to do before you go out anywhere? Okay, check the weather. You're going to just go out and look at the sky?
Call the weather reporter.
Call the ranger.
Call the ranger. Rangers don't know anything. They come to Stehekin and say, "Have you heard a forecast?" And I say, "No, what was the last one you heard?" And they say, "Yesterday." And that's inevitably sooner than we heard. And I suspect they have the same problem up here. But ask around. Check the newspaper. At least you may not know what the weather's doing in Seattle, but it might be an indication of what's going to happen. And usually by the time you get the paper, the weather that they're predicting for the next day is already on its way here, so it's not that far off. What else might you want to know about weather?
What it's been like.
Okay, past and present. And what it's been like may not mean much initially until you get into the studying of snow and weather conditions a little bit more, particularly as far as avalanches go. The other thing may be that, you know, you're going to have in your head that the last storm dumped a foot of snow. So when it starts snowing, you know, maybe this is going to be one of those 1 foot snows, and it's something you want to think about. What else? Okay, tell somebody where you're going. What are you going to tell them?
When you think you'll be back.
Okay.
Which way are you going?
Which way are you going? When do you think you'll be back?
How far are you going?
Okay, how far? I'm going to go up towards the Beaver Pond, but I'll probably turn around before I get there. What else? What if you're the leader of the group? You got 4 people going with you. Somebody else needs to know who those other 4 people are. Well, Don Roth this morning, he had 5 people with him, and I think one of them was his sister, and I'm not sure who other people were. It's real easy for a single person to say, "This is where I'm going," and be responsible for yourself, but if you're responsible for other people, or make sure your leader has told somebody. You know, if it's known that you all got in the car and drove off together, then you can probably assume that you all went to the same place, although not necessarily. We're going to the end of the road that's real steep, so why don't you let me off this other trailhead and I'll go for a short distance. Okay, what else? Oh, one other thing you might inform people about is how prepared you are. Now, if you're going someplace that either you've never been or is moderately dangerous, you know, I just mentioned, especially from here, you know, well, we've got our shovel and our avalanche board, or we've got lunch, but we don't have any extra food. So somebody that's going to worry knows how much to worry or when to start worrying about. Okay, what else? You got your map in your pack. You know where you're going? Probably want to talk to somebody who's been in that area, if possible. Now, you're not always going to be able to do that. Call it reconnaissance. You may look at places in the summer that you think about skiing back in the winter. You know, think about things different times of year. I walked through here on a blitz trip this summer, and the only thing I remember between here and Lyman Lake is that big slope just above, just below Hart Lake. And I looked at that and I said, I don't want to be under that in the winter. And that's, you know, it was just one of those things that sort of clicked in the back of my mind. If you can talk to somebody who's been where you're going, it helps a lot. Park rangers, forest rangers aren't always the best people to talk to, because some of them have been there for a long time. But see what you can find out. The other thing you do is, as I said before, study the map. Look at the map so you know the layout of the area. It may be that you're skiing along and you're having a good time, and you know, gosh, we go that way. Well, I need the map out. Let's go that way. If you've looked at the map before, you may say, oh yeah, that's that one that goes down to the little dam, so I want to go up, follow the trail the other way. What else? I already mentioned, eat a good breakfast, get a good night's sleep. Those are kind of standard things, and yet they make a lot of difference. They may not make much difference in a half-day trip or a very quick trip, but if you're out all day, you've sort of expended your day's energy. If you either ate a really good breakfast or got a really good night's sleep or ate a really good dinner the night before, it may make just that much difference. And it may not be a difference between survival and not surviving, but difference in, you know, having a reasonably good time and just really suffering through the end of the day. So even though I sort of pass over those lightly, they are important. Sort of self-preparation. Okay, what else? Okay, you're kind of ready to go, and you got everybody at the trailhead, and you told somebody where you're going, and you ready to take off? How do you know what?
Chains for the car.
Chains for the car, okay. Think about where, when you come back to the car, too. You may want to have a shovel to dig the car out when the snowplow comes by. So let's say you're the leader of this group. You've gathered everybody at the trailhead.
Make sure everybody has their experience.
Okay, their experience and their equipment. Know the people that you're with. And that, again, that sounds real easy, but particularly in college groups, you know, you just put up a notice on the bulletin board and six people show up Saturday morning at 8:30 in front of the student union. You don't have any idea what those people know, where they've been, or what equipment they've got. Now, if everybody has spare ski baskets, great, but if nobody has a first aid kit, you know, does somebody have a first aid kit? Well, it's better if you have more than one. Does somebody have a shovel? It's much better if you have more than one, but at least you know what everybody's got. Find out what they've got in the way of food. Moochers at lunchtime really aren't very welcome in the winter. You know, they're kind of okay in the summer. You may want to trade things, but if all of a sudden you're the only one with a really good lunch, and you get in trouble, you're going to be real popular. You may wish they didn't know what you had. And their experience is also important. That sort of goes back to knowing where you're going. Having talked to somebody else, well, it's not bad except for this 1 2-mile stretch. It's really hard if it's icy. You got somebody that's never skied before that has waxable skis and they don't know how to wax them. And, you know, just knowing a little bit more about those people. And probably Saturday morning at 8:30 is not the time to find that out, although that may be your last chance. So everybody's got what they need and they're all reasonably confident and ready to kick off. Right? So what's the last thing you should do before you kick off the trailhead? Real simple. It takes 3 seconds.
Do you have a marker or something? Beginning of the trail?
Yeah, let's say it's a well-ski trail. You know where you're going. What time did you leave? It's a really simple thing, but you figure, okay, we're going to meet at the trailhead at 8:30. Well, you really didn't get off till 9 o'clock by the time you repacked all your stuff and got the extra food out of the car and, you know, figured out what clothes you were going to wear and first finding the one that working and, you know, so you left at 9 o'clock. The only thing that may make a difference in is if you're in trouble later in the day. If it gets to be noon and everybody's really been struggling along, you've only been out for 3 hours, you've got 4 hours more daylight, maybe it's going to take you 4 hours to get back. If it's downhill, maybe it's only going to take 2 hours to get back. And so you've got to think about that all along the way, not just the time when you leave, but also, you know, note the time throughout the day. So you start off down the trail, and you know, you got to climb a steep hill right at the beginning. You always go uphill first thing in the morning. What's probably the next thing you're going to do? Take off your clothes. You're going to stop. And you're going to end up stopping a lot. And I think people that ski with me probably get tired of me stopping. Because I stop probably more than necessary. I like to be comfortable. You know, I don't want to sweat just a little bit. I don't want to be just a little bit cold. So I put on a shirt or I take off a shirt or whatever. If you get hot, take some clothes off. Unbutton your shirts, unzip your turtlenecks, take your hat off. The easiest way to cool off, take your hat off. Now, if your ear's going to be cold, then you need a little earband or a bandana or something. Because once you start sweating, you know, you started that process of getting wet. If you can keep that from happening, you're better off. And also, kind of, especially if you're the leader, stop and see where everybody else is. Maybe you've had a great breakfast and a good night's sleep and you're feeling real energetic, but they all had a party last night and they're kind of slow getting started, and you don't want to get too far separated. And I guess as a leader, that's something not only at the beginning, but all the way through the day, is just keep track of the group, not just where they are, but how they're doing. You say, you know, you stop for water break or something, you say, how are you doing? And good. Now, they're probably not doing very good, and they don't, and a lot of people in the outdoors have this problem dealing with problems. God, everybody else is having a great time, and if I tell them that I've got this terrible blister on my heel and I really want to go back, they're all going to be mad at me, so I'll just hug along. And it gets worse, and it gets worse, and it can be anything. It can be just simply being tired. Not enjoying yourself is no reason to be there. If somebody's not enjoying themselves, either a couple people ought to go back, or maybe everybody's going to turn back. And that's probably the hardest thing to do, and I still don't like to do it, is to turn back before you planned on it. But if you need to, do it. It can make a lot of difference at the end of the day, and it's a lot more critical at that point. Get into a lot more stuff. The one other thing you want to do all day long, I love this, eat and drink. It's a lot better to eat four times during an 8-hour ski trip than it is to eat lunch. You're burning off calories at a lot higher rate than you normally do, and probably the way we normally eat isn't that great either, but it's a lot more convenient for businesses and schools and things to have lunch at lunch. You saw a lot of little bags of stuff. I take a lot of times I don't even take a lunch. I'll have a lot of little things to munch all day long. You know, candy bars are okay, fruit and nuts and raisins and gorp and all kinds of things are. It's better to just keep the fuel level up than to get it really low. And you eat a big lunch, and you get up, you really don't feel like skiing at all right after lunch. And if you're cold, you want to go uphill, and all the blood's trying to get to the stomach, and it really doesn't want to go out to the legs and muscles to get you uphill, and it really makes it a lot harder. So do that. But once you're going along all day long, there's a bunch of things you want to watch as you're going. We mentioned the people in the group. What else do you want to keep an eye on? The weather, sure. It's easy to notice when it goes from being really good to really bad. It's probably a little harder to notice when it goes from being not really great to start with, but it's okay, to being a little bit worse. If it's a real gradual change, you might not even notice that the temperature's been dropping all day, or the clouds have been getting lower or thicker or whatever. So do keep an eye on the weather. Wind is another weather factor which can be real important, so keep tuned into that. Now we're getting a little more technical, and if you haven't been out much, this may sort of not make any sense at this point. Skiing along, what else are you going to watch besides the people and the weather? Something you think about more up here particularly.
Night.
Okay, the time of day, sure. You want to keep an eye on the time, all the time. The other thing is just changes in the snow. We'll talk about what changes you're looking for, but anything that tells you something's different. You're skiing along and the snow's real crusty, you get these big cracks running out in front of your skis, or you're skiing along and all of a sudden the snow, you're standing there looking at the scenery and it goes, oh. Or you hear noises in the background, then you're real worried. But different changes in the texture, changes in the way that your skis react. Now, as temperatures change, you know, wax is going to be different, things are going to change that way, and that may be a perfectly normal, you know, warming up in the middle of the day and cooling off in the afternoon. What else? you're the leader of this group. You're new to Holden, but you said just, they said just follow this track up to the Beaver Ponds. Okay, you gotta watch the terrain. And that sounds really easy. In most cases, trails that are established and skied on, you know, whether they're here or somewhere else, if they're here, they may tell you whether they're safe or closed or not. Whether you're crossing gullies, whether you're going across open bowls, whether you're following ridges, and not only from the standpoint of safety for avalanches and snow, but also where you're going, so you're not going to get lost. Pretty basic terrain changes. The other thing you want to watch out for the group, for the people in the group, are sort of medical emergencies. How many of you were here for Kent's talk last week? Anybody? I don't want to get in, probably won't get into as much detail on some of that. And some of it I'm sure you've heard. Things to watch out for on other people, really simple, are things like frost nip, which is sort of the beginning stages of frostbite. May get just a little white spot on the end of your nose. You may not even notice it, but somebody else can see it on you. Ears, the same way. Things that get frostbite most are fingers, toes, ears, nose, cheeks a little bit, but not as much. Frostbite itself, full-fledged frostbite, is actually frozen tissue. I mean, the skin has just been out there so long and it hasn't been getting heated blood that it freezes. And that's a long process. It doesn't just go out and get frostbite. And it usually starts with something that may be tingling a little bit numb. Noses are the only thing that I've ever seen really get that way. I don't really know why. It seems like there'll be enough blood up there, but it's around the blood vessels of the nose or something. And the only thing you do is just warm it up. And you can rub it a little bit. If it's hands, you can shake them, you know, get the blood flowing down to the end of your fingers. Feet, sometimes people will stomp on the ground, or even with your skis on, just sort of run in place, get the blood going down just a little bit harder. And it is a lack of the circulating blood that's causing that problem. You're just not getting the heated blood to where it needs to be. Once it's actually frozen tissue, you've got a little bit more concern about it. You don't want to rub it. If you can imagine just taking a piece of, very thin piece of frozen meat and going like this with it, it's just going to kind of shred it up. And that's what happens. So it needs to be warmed, but it's got to be a lot more gently once it's actually frozen. If you're, hopefully you're not getting to this point, but if you're in extreme conditions and you have, for instance, frozen feet, and I mean frozen feet, not just the way I get frozen feet all the time, actually, you know, frozen tissue, it's okay to walk, continue walking or skiing on frozen feet. But once they thaw out, for one thing, they're going to swell up and you're not going to be able to walk. And you don't want to walk once they're thawed out. So if you've decided that you're going to thaw a frozen foot, figure out how else you're going to get that person out, or figure out if they can keep going on the frozen extremity. For things like hands and nose and ears, the best thing is just body heat. You know, put your hand over your nose and breathe a little bit, make it a little moisture in there, but it's going to warm it up. You can stick hands in armpits. If you have good friends, you can stick feet on bellies. Bellies are good warmer uppers, but you've got really good friends. It's cold. The best thing is to put it in warm water. Now, if you're skiing out on the trail, you're probably not going to have a lot of warm water handy. If you get back to the village or wherever, that's fairly rapidly is what you want to do is just thaw it out, and that's all you're doing is putting in water. And not hot water. Basically, comfortable dishwater, you know, maybe a little bit warmer than you normally like. I lived in Montana for a while, and my feet were always cold. I had this great bathroom with a counter next to the bathroom sink. And I'd come home from work, put my feet in the sink, you know. But if the water's too hot, it actually heats too fast, and they tingle, and they hurt. Tingling's not really a bad sign. It means the circulation is going again, but it's not a real comfortable feeling. The other thing we talked about a little bit about is hypothermia. Hopefully all of you know at least a little bit about hypothermia. It's simply a cooling of body temperature to the point that you can't warm yourself up anymore. In newspapers and things, a lot of times they'll talk about people dying from exposure. Well, it isn't exposure that killed them, it's their body temperature that killed them. And it's simply, it's a very progressional thing that can happen fast, but you don't simply lay down and die of exposure. It happens over time. And all that happens is that you're losing body heat faster than you can produce it. And things that contribute to that are wet garments, wet cotton garments in particular. Wind can actually cause hypothermia. Even if you're dry, wind carries body heat away from you. You're sort of radiating it out all the time anyway, and it sucks it away a lot faster. So it doesn't necessarily have to be wet, that's usually what it happens. It doesn't have to be in the middle of winter. Actually, probably a lot more hypothermia cases happen like in the spring and the fall when people aren't as prepared. Going out in the winter, you got all this great gear with you. But, you know, hunters, I think, in the fall particularly tend to get caught by, you know, wet weather, and they're not prepared for it a lot more often. Somebody that's getting hypothermia starts out being just a little bit not very coordinated. You might just think they're, you know, being normal, but they don't talk quite as clearly as they should. They may stumble around a lot. They're kind of incoherent. They don't really make much sense. They may not talk very well. Their speech is kind of slurred. They act like they're drunk a little bit. The other thing they will have is intense shivering. And this guy that we hauled out of the lake in the canoe was probably in the early stages of hypothermia. Shivering is actually a way of producing heat. It's making your muscles work, and you actually do get warmer when you shiver to a certain point. The other thing that does is drain a lot of energy out of you. It takes a lot of energy to shiver. And because of that, very soon thereafter, you're going to get a feeling, a very strong feeling of fatigue. And they really just don't think they can go on anymore. They kind of just like to sit down. They may just say they want to sit down and take a rest. Well, sit down and take a rest, and then they're not going to want to get back up again. Ken has a horror story of a friend of his that he was hiking with, and they would go along, and they thought they should be at camp, and they weren't at camp, and it was cold, and it was raining, but it was damp, and the guys kind of stumbled along, and they stopped to look at where they were going and look at the map, and the guy just wasn't. You know, he was involved in the decision process, but he wasn't doing anything. Finally, Ken said, Jim, why don't you put a sweater on? And he just sat there and looked at it. Ken said, like, Jim can't put a sweater on. I'll put a sweater on for him. And the only thing you can do at that point is try to get him heated up with outside sources. Put more clothes on. If they have wet clothes on, take the wet clothes off, put the dry clothes on. You may end up with your outer coat on over bare skin. If that's all you've got that's dry, put that on. It may take body heat. Somebody that's, you know, fairly extreme may actually need to lay a sleeping bag or in a tent with somebody else next to them. They're not producing enough heat on their own. They need somebody else's heat to keep them warm. Obviously, if you can bring them in and set them next to a heater, a fireplace or something, that's a lot better. In most cases, you're not going to be able to do that. The other thing at that point is that person has been working. They've already gone through all that shivering and tense muscles, and they're tired, and they really need to rest. And if it's cold and snowing or raining, they're not going to be able to rest much unless you've got your emergency shelter or you can get them back fairly quickly to secure shelter. If you've got a fire or you can get a fire going, Ken had a stove and I guess he made some tea or something, get hot liquids into them, you're starting to warm it from the inside, which is obviously a lot more effective. It's a lot harder to do out in the woods. That will help a lot. Ken said he gave this guy a cup of tea and it's kind of like he woke up in the morning and he knew why they were there, but it was just a drastic difference once he got warm liquid in it. If you don't stop it at that point, you're going to get into extreme conditions, at which point there will be no problem recognizing it, unless it's you yourself. You don't recognize it in yourself in most cases. You're going to get blue skin. You know, tissue is maybe not freezing, but it's not getting that circulation. It's not getting any heat. It may get a little bit puffy. You know, you're just kind of... Again, the lack of circulation, the blood's not moving around. They're going to stop shivering eventually, but they're not going to be relaxed. They're just going to be, they're still going to have really tense, almost rigid muscles. Sort of a pre-rigor mortis state. I mean, they're tensed up. They may have their hands clenched, and you're not going to be able to get them unclenched. If they're sitting, you know, they've been cold, they're sitting like this, and you tell them to get up and get the tent, well, they're not going to get up on their own, so you're going to help them, and you're going to pick them up, and they're just going to kind of move around. They really get stiff, very rigid. If you're into checking, they may have a very slow pulse, it may be very weak or irregular, depending on, you know, what stage they're at. And this is sort of a critical stage. If you don't get them warm now, you may not have to worry about getting them warm at all. At this point, insulation doesn't do any good. Putting dry coat or dry clothes on them isn't going to do any good. Putting them in a sleeping bag in a dry tent isn't going to do any good. Because all a sleeping bag does is keep your body heat in. It doesn't produce any heat. So So if they're that way, you got to get in the sleeping bag. Somebody else got to get in the sleeping bag. If they're conscious and aren't going to choke on it, you can give them hot liquids. Now, Kent was saying there was something in one of the books he was reading that said, don't give hot liquids to a hypothermia patient. Well, the only thing that I can interpret that to mean is if the person is unconscious, obviously you're not going to pour anything down their throat. They're going to choke on it. I don't know what else, you know,
I remember that too, and I checked on it in some of the other books we have, and that's the only thing I could find, other than not to, even if the person is conscious, not to remember that they might not be able to have a sense of how hot the liquid is, so make sure that it's very warm, but not hot enough that it could burn their mouth. It's the only thing I could find.
The thing that can happen very easily at this point, which is something to remember, particularly if you've got the rescue team or somebody here, is that they can be put into shock very easily. And rough handling, riding down in the sled, can actually put their heart into fibrillation where it's not pumping any blood effectively. And so even though you're trying to warm them up and you're trying to do it quickly, you've still got to be pretty gentle with them. They're in shock anyway. They're going to have the standard symptoms of shock, but you can make it much worse if you don't. Just be gentle. That's the simple way to do it. Anytime that you're a little bit cold and a little bit wet and there's a little bit of wind, first thing you got to be thinking about is hypothermia. What am I doing to prevent it more than what am I going to do to get somebody out of it once it happens? I mentioned hypothermia thermometer. It doesn't do a lot of good to know whether it's 75 or 80 degrees in the field. They will definitely want to know when you get them in here or into a hospital. Heated oxygen that they can inhale. Heated IV fluids, lots of things like that make a lot better cure than anything we can do. And again, just rewarming, not in super hot water. Probably the best you're going to be able to do, I don't know what Mary Beth can do, but Mary Beth's out. The best you can do is get them in a tub of hot water. That's not heating them from the inside, but at least it's giving them some extra heat. And again, moderately heated temperatures. The easiest thing about hypothermia is to prevent it. It's a lot harder to pull somebody out of it. Probably not going to have much problem here with altitude sickness, any kind of pulmonary edema or anything. You have to get 8,000, 10,000 feet before that's a big problem. It's something to think about if you know you're going to be at higher elevations for a longer time. Sunburn and snow blindness are things that happen very easily. I'll show you pictures next weekend, which is grim. Beet red faces. Really dumb to forget your sunscreen. Other injuries, cross-country skiing and snowshoeing, are not particularly common, but they're things to think about. Your basic ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation, stop any bleeding. Fractures, that probably strains are more common than anything else. You might get a sprain or a dislocation. You should know how to do something about all those things. And again, prevention is a lot easier. If you see a slope that's too steep, don't go down it. Go around it somehow. Dislocated things are extremely hard to do anything with in the backcountry. Exhaustion is another pretty simple thing. It sneaks up on people for some reason. You just go and you go until you just can't go anymore. Particularly if you're coming down something real steep late in the afternoon. There may be somebody, and I've done this with backpacks on overnight trips. You go for a little ways and you're really kind of out of control, and the only way you can stop is to fall down. Well, then you can fall down, you can brush the snow off, pick your pack off and stand up and kind of get yourself together, or pick your pack up again and go another 20 feet and do the same thing all over. You don't do that very many times before you really start running out of energy. And you might just try it on a good section of the road or something. If you can get a steep stretch, there's a sort of an improvised snow plow carry where you're snow plowing and somebody just comes up behind you, grabs on either around your shoulders or around your waist. They may try to snow plow, but they're probably not going to do much. And all you're going to be able to do is slow both of you down. It's going to have to be pretty controlled, or you're both going to fall down. You're going to fall on top of them, which means they're going to be in worse shape yet. It's something to think about, although it's not easy to do, and it's probably not real practical most of the time. If somebody has fallen, you have to think about how to get them out. If you've got all this nifty equipment, you can probably rig up some sort of emergency sled. If you're real inventive, and I challenge anybody to do this well, you can take two skis, great arts. Two poles, and all these nifty little sticks that you cut out of the woods and make braces, and actually make a sled you can lay somebody on and pull over. It's extremely difficult to do that and have it work very well. It can be done. Probably with as much cord as I've got, I could make one, you know, that wouldn't flex too much. The one thing to think about is if somebody's going to fall off the thing, it's not going to do much good, especially if you're on a steep, icy slope. It can be done. It's something to play with sometime when you're... And obviously an actual sled, whatever the team has for rescues, is a lot more efficient. If you are caught out, you have to spend the night out, and you weren't planning on it, if you carried a 35-pound pack, you'd probably be reasonably comfortable. If you've got your belt packed, it's probably going to be a real long night. There's not much you can do. You're going to be cold. If you're wet, you're probably going to stay wet. You can try to build a fire, which in the snow is a lot easier said than done. You figure if you want to keep a fire going, think about when you make campfires. If you want to keep a fire going for a couple hours, how much wood you had to have. If you're going to sit there all night, now at some point you're going to get exhausted and fall asleep. But if you want to keep a fire going, say for 4 hours, you probably ought to plan on at least an hour out gathering enough wood to keep it going. Now you may want to get it going and then go get a little bit more once you've got warmed up. Getting it going, you've got your waterproof matches and your candle. It may be hard to find a little bit of tinder, and you take your nifty knife and you whittle some sticks down and you get some shavings. Simple things that, you know, are going to make a lot of difference when the time comes. A lot of times you can find dry wood under rocks or under other big logs, stuff that hasn't been really saturated. Consider where you're building the fire. Now, obviously, if you can pack it down with your skis a little bit, you've got a pretty good platform. The thing you're probably going to want to do is feel secure, so you're going to back up next to a rock or a tree or something. If you're under a tree, and you build this nice fire, all the snow that's on that tree is going to come down, put the fire out, and go down on you. It's, again, it's a really simple little thing to think about, but if you don't think about it, you'll be real unhappy when the snow falls. If you don't want to build a fire, I've never spent a night out in deep snow without planning on it when I didn't have enough stuff to survive. Fires are difficult. There's a certain psychological benefit in having a fire. It makes you feel better once you get it going. There are easier ways to survive, and again, if you've got a reasonable amount of extra clothing, what you should be fairly comfortable. One of them is that you can just dig a trench. Again, I don't know if I can draw this very well. This is the snow surface. You just dig a little side view, a little trench, you can lay down in it. You're going to have snow on essentially all three sides of you, plus the head and the foot. You can get branches and put them over the bottom, maybe pack some snow on top of that. You've got your emergency shelter, you can maybe lay that over the top of it. One thing to remember about this is if you cover up your whole face, you're going to get feeling real claustrophobic. But it doesn't take long with a ski pole or just your hands to dig out a little place to kind of scoop down into it and lay down into it. You don't have to move very much snow. If you can do it up against a rock or a tree, you might feel better. You know, you've got something solid to lean against. It's one way to do it. The old mountain men would build you a lean-to, and again, with, you know, 16 yards of cord and 4 hours of sharp axe, you might be able to build a lean-to. You might be able to just simply string up a rope and put your tarp across it and build your fire in front of it. It's going to reflect a little bit of heat that way. You have to get inventive at this point. A lot of people say, well, I just dig a snow cave, I got my shovel. If you can dig a snow cave, you can dig anything you'll be comfortable in. Surviving in it is something else again. Most good snow caves for two or three people to spend the night in are going to take 2 or 3 hours to dig. So if you've got 2 or 3 extra hours and that much energy and you're not going to get soaking wet, which you are anyway, go ahead and go for a snow cave. We talked about maybe trying to do one, but unless there's a big windrift someplace I haven't seen, I don't think there's enough snow. It takes about 6 feet of snow, 6 feet down and 6 feet in, to dig a reasonable sized snow cave. Dig your roof out, because all the cold air is going to come right along the ground and fill up your snow cave with cold air. If you can dig in, the distance between the outside of this sort of overhang, and when you start going up, ought to be about 3 feet, which is a lot of snow to move. Go in, just a straight tunnel in, about 3 feet, and then start going up. And the distance between the bottom of this overhang and your actual floor ought to be pretty close to a foot, and that can be a little bit less. But your cold air is going to get trapped right here in the doorway. So once you get inside, you've got, you know, the warm air. Snow, like I say, snow's a good insulator. Once you get in it, couple of candles and three bodies, and it's toasty in there. You'll have snow dripping off the ceiling pretty quick. One thing you don't want to do is have little notches like that on the roof. The smoother you can make it, the better you're going to be, because as I say, it will melt, and every little shovel hole you've got is going to be a drip spot. So people that spend, you know, longer times, I mean, eventually the whole thing is going to get glazed with ice. But if you can get it so that the ice actually runs down the roof to the floor, you're a lot better. You can dig all kinds of little cubby holes for your candles and sleeping shelves and wings, and you know, you get real carried away with them. They are kind of fun if you've got the time sometimes, even someplace close by, to just go out and do it. The one thing, once you get it dug, a couple of things to remember. One is that you're probably going to want a vent hole. If it snows a whole bunch overnight, this entrance is going to get filled up. And you're not going to suffocate. Snow is permeable enough you can breathe through it. The easiest thing is just to do is take the handle of your ski pole and stick it down through it, and you've got a vent hole. And especially if you're cooking, if you've got a camp stove or something in there, it's going to let a little more of those fumes get out. It also just makes you feel better that you've got an opening to the outside. The other thing you want to do is do something on the surface, particularly if you've got a thin snow layer, so that anybody else or even yourself can find that snow cave. You're not going to fall into it.